Hello, welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Jonathan Last, sitting in for host Charlie Sykes today. I'm joined by my colleague Jim Swift and the great Mark McKinnon, who is a surprise in-studio guest. It is fantastic to have you here on essentially like 15 minutes notice.
Well, long-time listener, first-time caller. Glad to be here.
So you have come to town because you're taping The Circus this week?
Yeah. The show started off as a show about campaigns, and it was a 2016 campaign. I thought then we'd be one and done, maybe come back in 2020. But 1 week into this administration, the suits at Showtime called and said, get back out there. The circus hadn't stopped. So, and by the way, my first reaction to that was skeptical. I thought, I don't know if this is going to work out of Washington. It's kind of static.
Little did you know.
How interesting could it be? Of course, I couldn't have been more wrong, just for all the reasons that are obvious to you and your listeners, I'm sure. It's just people are fascinated by what's going on.
So you guys tape Monday through Saturday, and you air on Sunday. How does that work? Like, who do you have a team of 50 people in an editing booth at
60.
An Avid machine?
To, 60.
Like, it must be insane. Yeah. Do they do it all Saturday night, or are you editing on the fly all week
yeah,
long?
Yeah, so I appreciate the appreciation for the turn that we do, because especially from people in the business, because you get it, right? It's insanely difficult to do, because we're making a documentary in a week. I mean, we're doing what people usually take months to do.
And you're shooting how many hours worth of footage as you go?
It's probably 10 to 1, something like that.
No, it's got
to
be insane.
And it took me a long time, but I started pitching the show in 2003. And the response was always, TV executives would say, wait a minute, I'm going to see the show that airs Sunday night, Sunday morning? I don't think so. And so, but finally Showtime liked the concept and was willing to put a gamble on it and see if we could do it. But, I tell you, it's gotten easier, but it's never easy. But the first couple of months we were doing the show, it was like assembling an airplane on the runway. And
I'm sorry to monopolize, but I'm fascinated by how this works.
So we feed it back real time. And by the way, I thought at the beginning we might shoot some evergreen stuff and have stuff on the shelf ready to go just for, rough weeks or whatever. The other thing that I was surprised by is when we first got the show, they said we were going to do 26 episodes, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And I thought there's just going to be weeks where there's not that much going on. It's never happened.
Yeah.
Ever. Our challenge every week is, what are we going to cut?
Has technology made it easier?
Yes.
I mean, 2003, I'm thinking, the technology gap between then and now.
Great point. In fact, we couldn't have done it in 2003. So I'm glad.
At least not like you do it now.
Well, yeah. I mean, we would have been, we would have been FedExing half-inch tapes and, that sort of thing. We
literally had to have people sitting in an Avid machine instead of just doing Final Cut Pro.
So now, so what we do now is we shoot and we upload media from wherever we are to New York. And so the editing process begins almost immediately as we're shooting.
How do you craft the storylines for the show? Because, I mean, the document, you're essentially doing what we do, which is magazine long-form journalism.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're doing it, again, in real time. And often when you're out reporting someplace for a week, you don't really know. You don't know what the story is until the last day you're
there. Another really good point. So a couple things. One is, when we first came up with the idea of the show, I just thought, we'll just go shoot a bunch of stuff and it'll be interesting. And they were like, no, that's not the way Hollywood works. And of course, they were right. So if you watch the show, you'll notice every show has a theme.
Yeah, no, it's all a story.
We try and tie it all to in a narrative. And that's really tough with this president. First of all, it's because of this president there was a season 2, 3, and 4 that probably wouldn't have been with Hillary Clinton. But part of the reason is that, what makes great drama? Interesting characters, conflict, and surprise. And we get that every single day with him. But on the other hand, there have been lots of Fridays where we kind of tore up the show.
Yeah, I bet.
Because Pussygate happened on a Friday.
What percentage of the time would you say that come Saturday, you have the show you thought you were setting out to film on Monday? Was it like half the time, less than half, more than half?
About half.
Yeah.
About half.
Pretty good ratio, actually.
Yeah, yeah. But, we just have really nimble people and wizards for editors, and I'm constantly amazed at what they do and what they pull off.
Has your editing team won an Emmy? Because they should.
I agree, they should.
As talented as the in front of the camera talent is, obviously.
No, they deserve a ton of credit, because they really work magic.
That's awesome. I mean, so I don't monopolize. Mark, what are you? Do you have questions, thoughts?
Well, I'm trying.
How tall is Heilman in real life?
Yeah,
he's a
giant.
6'9".
And I'm a little guy. Yeah, he's huge. He's huge.
He looks giant. Now, how big is he? 6'5"?
I guess 6'5".
Yeah,
something like that.
Big guy.
So I also worked for the Bush campaign in 2004, and I have all of the ads you guys did saved in like a directory. from, you know, 2004. I saved them because I was I dropped out of college. I worked on the campaign for a semester. I went back and I was studying marketing and advertising. And I thought, I'm going to go into this. This is such a fun, exciting field. But alas, no. First, you know, I went to the Hill and I came here, and now I'm in journalism. And it just struck me, and I think this was from the season premiere, where you're on the Hill with your camera crew, just asking the legislators outside of the subway as they walk by, oh, hey, you know, how's it going? And you got to sit down and talk with Mitt Romney, who, of course, I'm sure you know very well. Do you get the sense that some of these freshman lawmakers, I have no idea that Mark McKinnon is there trying to ask them questions, and they could get national exposure if they just stop for 1 second?
Yeah, I think so. That's a really interesting observation, because you'd think they would. I mean, that's kind of why they're in the game, right? And that's why we do the show.
Right.
And but it was interesting, because when we first did the show, when people didn't know who we were, it was really hard getting the kind of access that we want to have on the show. But I tell you, those first couple of months when we were, you know, you're going to do what, and you want, and what kind of show is it, and what are you doing exactly? So, but the idea is that there's a real, you know, it's a wild time that we're in, but there's a real noble purpose behind the show. And by the way, thank you for serving in 2004. I love campaigns and I love politics, and I just want to show more of it, because I think showing more of it makes it is educational, and it's, and it can be entertaining as well. But at the end of the day, I appreciate what people do who run for office and who are office holders, because I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the people that do. And so this is a forum for people to really to – so that it's not just a one-dimensional experience. I mean, we can really – this last episode that we did, we kind of spent the day with – actually 2 days with Eric Swalwell before he did his committee hearing, the Intelligence Committee hearing. And it showed a ton of stuff about the preparation for the hearing, what questions he was going to ask, and how that all happens, which, I thought was really educational for people who are interested in politics.
As someone who's a huge, you know, I guess we're all political nerds. I mean, I appreciate the show, but in watching it, I could also sense that someone who does not follow politics, someone who does not tweet, do you think that they appreciate the show more than the political nerds?
In some ways, yeah, because I think for a lot of people, there's just a fury of information going on right now. It's just, and they feel like they're drinking out of a fire hose. And every time they turn on the TV, it's some new developing story every 30 minutes or faster. And I think that because of that, particularly if you're not a political nerd, you don't have an idea or a sense of what was important that day or that week. And at least we get a week to kind of stand back, put a theme on it, and kind of contextualize everything for the week in a fun, fast, kind of loose way on Sunday night, so that they can just kind of say, you know, I'm just going to plug in Sunday night and see what the circus has to say.
Are you done doing campaigns?
I am so done. I am so done.
So what is – I have a whole bunch of campaign questions. Who is your favorite campaign guru? For me, campaign guys are my favorite animal the entire political world.
They're so colorful and so interesting. Again, that's another reason I want to do the show. Is I wanted to show not just the candidate, but these other –
campaign guys are the best,
the best.
Yeah, I want to vote for them.
Yeah,
like,
James Carville.
Stevens or Mike Murphy. Those are the guys I want to vote for.
All three of those guys I've worked with, and I love all three of them. And
do you bike with Stu?
I bike a ton with Stu. I'll tell you a quick Stu Stevens story. So Stuart Stevens is a colleague, and I hired him to work with me on the Bush campaign. And he's a super talented guy, but he's also kind of he's insanely he writes books. He's super talented across the board. He's a good campaign guy, but he writes novels. He writes travel books.
His travel book is fantastic.
Yeah, right. And but he's also he's kind of a manic sports enthusiast, just in the sense that he like does weird ski races and weird bike races. And at the time when he came to Austin in 2000, I was in a triathlon phase. And Stuart showed up and he was like, oh, that sounds interesting. You know, I want to do a triathlon. So he started training with me for his first triathlon. We go to the triathlon, we do it. My bike breaks in the middle of the race, so I did not finish, DNF'd, and carried my bike back to the finish line. I'm waiting for Stuart. He finally shows up, and I'm mad about the outcome, you know. So I just want to get out of there. I'm like, let's go. And he's like, well, let's wait just a few minutes. He's kind of whining about it, like he just kind of wants to stick around. I don't understand why. And then I hear from the podium, in second place, Stuart Stevens. you bastard. Yeah. So Stuart was a super colorful guy. Carville was Hall of Fame first ballot. You know, that was my first campaign.
He's
too. And he was so bizarre that we had to get a different location for him because he was scaring the staff. We had to isolate him.
Did you read Stu's amazing piece about doing steroids outside?
Yeah,
that was one of the greatest sports
it was
pieces
such
I've
a,
ever.
Such a great idea and such an interesting concept. And I think it was called I Cheated. I think that was the name
of it. I think that was,
something
yeah,
like
it was
that.
Just
but it was fascinating because he doped. And he did it with the supervision of a doctor and reported what that was
like. Well, to answer the question that I had always wondered is it like a 2% edge or a 20% edge? Right. You know, are we really talking about the margins or is it something real?
Yeah,
he came back thinking
super
real.
Of that on that topic, have you seen the recent documentary where a bike guy kind of did the same thing?
I've heard about it. Is it good?
Oh, it's spectacular because it turns into – it takes a whole right turn in the middle of the thing. He's like doping and like analyzing the results. And then he kind of stumbles into the Russian doping thing. And that becomes the tip of the spear that exposes the Russian doping scandal.
No kidding.
Yeah, so it's a good movie.
That's awesome. So favorite of those guys. Is Carvel your favorite that you
In terms of the most colorful, most crazy, wildest, and brilliant, too. You know, that's the sneaky thing about him. He's got this Louisiana cracker kind of accent thing that throws people off, and they think, well, maybe he's not all that smart, and he's genius level.
Is he going to come back and work another campaign someday?
So.
Or is he just done? Like, once you win the Tour de France, you don't have to do it again?
Well, that's kind of it. You know, once you get the ring, it's why go do it again? I look around, there's not a lot of old people doing it.
That's right.
Running campaigns.
A lot of people have the energy to do it. It
takes a ton of energy.
Or, you know, like once you have a family, do it twice once if you have a family.
Yeah, and being in a presidential campaign is. I remember once during the Bush campaign, there was one night where something happened, and I just wasn't paying complete attention, and something screwed up on my watch. Now, fortunately, in that circumstance, it was like not fatal, but it could have been. And I just had this moment where I was like, McKinnon, if you're going to do this, you cannot hit the pause switch until this thing's over.
Yeah.
And as a result, I mean, it's kind of like your body and your brain are like amped up to ridiculous levels of like insulin and stuff. So that after we won and I was depressed afterwards. It's like I had this biological, physical kind of meltdown. And I talked to my counterpart that worked for Gore. And I said, Jesus, I can't imagine what you're going through to go through all that and lose.
Yeah. I'm so happy you guys named it the circus because whenever I would go out on the campaign trail in presidential elections and be like out in Iowa for a week and then go straight to New Hampshire for a week and then head down to South Carolina for a week. It literally felt like I would tell my wife, it feels like I've run away to join the circus. And then when you finally cycle off of it, like you're happy because you can sleep again and everything, but you do feel like there's this awesome thing happening over there.
Yeah.
And I'm now missing it because I'm back in wherever, you know, back home living.
Well, then
like
now you can just go watch the circus.
And now we can watch
this
the
is
circus.
My way
it's the best
of
all worlds.
My hand in it, but not having to do it, but I can just go film it.
What's your best campaign story? You can blind whoever it is if you don't want to embarrass whoever it was on the race.
Well, I'll just tell you the most bizarre thing that happened to me was something called Tapegate. And so this is the year 2000.
I remember that, yeah.
And it's like early October maybe, late September, early October. And first of all, you know, we're in a very precarious position in the campaign. We were up a little bit, then we were down. So we were down like 3 points or something. And so it was just not a good mood in the campaign. Everybody was kind of pointing fingers at everybody else for things being screwed up, including me. And it's like, oh, the ads suck. You know, we're in a tailspin. McKinnon's screwing this thing up. And I walk into my office, and there's FBI agents tearing out all my computers. I'm like, hello, what are you doing? As it turns out, someone had obtained and mailed a debate tape of a rehearsal with George Bush and a notebook and mailed it to the Gore campaign.
And it was you.
Well, that's what everybody thought. And I couldn't blame him either because I was like the recently reformed Democrat who'd crossed the bridge to work in Republican politics because of George Bush. So that was – I mean, people just thought, oh, yes, of course. He's a spy and has been all along, and that's what the deal is. And so it was the spookiest thing. It was a real, you know, Kafka-esque experience where I walked into the campaign and it felt like everybody was looking at me. I don't know if they all were, but it just, I mean, that's what it felt like. It's like they're all staring at me and they all think I did it. And it was a horror show. And as it turned out, it was somebody from my office. It was a woman who worked for me. It was really the receptionist.
Really?
Yeah. And she went to prison for a year.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I that was so beyond my imagination that at first I like went way out on a limb and said it couldn't be her. That's just ridiculous. She was like a babysitter, you know, and turns out she was way more complicated than any of us knew. And had a lot of problems.
Was she a pro in all this, or was she just like somebody who made a stupid mistake or was disturbed? Or
kind of disturbed and a pathological liar and kind of wanted to be more of a person than she really was. And this was a way to kind of get famous. And I think came from like a Democratic family and probably had some guilt about what she was doing. And this was a way to kind of make her feel better about what she was doing. Her father was like, you know, worked for Gore in the Valley or something. And so,
well, she succeeded in getting famous.
She did. She did. You know, and I, at first I thought, I think the last words I had with her were, you know, don't, if you're doing this for somebody else, don't, you know, don't fall on your sword for somebody else, you know, because I just, I, it didn't make any sense.
That's wild. Jim, yeah. Can you ask about the McCain-Obama stuff? I want to hear that.
As someone who's kind of been part of our site and what we do is about conservatism and, you know, the kind of fear and Trumpian fear that we have and everything. And I always thought it was interesting that the story I had read, and I was hoping you could maybe tell our listeners about your agreement with Senator McCain in the 08 race. Yep. And I thought that was a really neat thing as, you know, as someone who, you know, was just working on the Hill and worked for McCain's counterpart and everything. And when I read that, I was just like, yeah, that's such a neat story.
Well, it was a unique circumstance. I love McCain, and I was a big fan of his even during the bad Bush days, even during the South, you know, even during the primary, because I knew John Weaver and some other people who worked for McCain. So I was always kind of a back channel with the McCain campaign, even during the troubles. So I kept that line open, and I just always loved McCain and revered him for all the obvious reasons. And then of course, he was very helpful to us in 2004 and then invited me over for a lunch in the Senate one day and said, you know, I said, I'd go mow your lawn in Sedona for you if you wanted me to. He said, well, how about we skip that, but why don't you come help me with my campaign? And I said, okay, sure. I'm glad to do it. And then I thought a little bit about it, and I realized that there was a potential issue. And the issue was this guy named Barack Obama, who was, I think, just talking about running at that point. And I had met Obama and I liked him. I didn't agree with his politics, but I thought his candidacy, if he ran, I thought the candidacy would be good for the country. To have a, you know, to have a black candidate in America who could really inspire people, I thought would be good. And I kind of played it through in my mind. I thought, well, if McCain wins the nomination and Obama wins the nomination, I'm going to be the guy that's going to have to be attacking him. I'll be the tip of the spear. And I'm not going to be really comfortable doing that. And by the way, I probably shouldn't be the guy doing it because you don't want somebody who's got like a soft trigger finger. The rumble's going to get pretty tough. And so you want to have the brass knuckles on. So what I did was I wrote a memo to McCain and because I knew that he would probably forget. And I also knew that I'd try and back out of it. That was kind of the purpose for running. And I also wanted the senior staff to know. And I said, okay, here's the deal. I love you. I'm going to work my ass hard off for you to get you the nomination. But if this guy Obama for some reason wins, of course nobody thought he would. And by the way, that's why McCain just kind of said, yeah, sure, whatever, because he didn't think Obama was going to win, and I frankly didn't either at the time. And then it happened, and sure enough, McCain had forgotten. And so I like pulled the memo from the file and I walked and said, Senator, and he looked at me and said, God, man. Damn it, McKinnon. But, you know, and in classic style, he gave me a big hug and he said, listen, it would be very un-McCain-like not to keep your word. And so appreciate it and carry on without you.
And his campaign struggled with attacking Obama. McCain tried to keep things above board, at least personally.
Yeah.
In his own words and actions. But then there was the bizarre celebrity ad, which kind of came out of nowhere and is still kind of mocked like Carly Fiorina demon sheep and things like that. But do you think your memo kind of had any effect on that decision by McCain, or was he just normally that kind of a guy to make it so personal?
I think it had zero impact on him. I think that's just his nature. And, you know, the time where he defended Obama on the birther stuff at that debate, and he said, you know, he's a, I forget the exact exchange, but, you know, he stood up and said, no, but that's not what we're going to do here. This guy's a, you know, he's a patriot and he's run for the right reasons and he has every right to.
Yeah, we get a lot of that today.
Right.
So you had been saying for a long time that the Republican Party was going to blow up.
Yeah, I just had no idea it was going to be like this.
So what – it's a couple questions. The first is, what was it that you were seeing that led you to believe that from the start?
You know, I was compelled to become a Republican because of George Bush and his message about compassionate conservatism, which I just found very powerful, still do. And it took me across the bridge, and I think drew a lot of others across the bridge as well to support the party. And then just over the course of the decade, we saw a lot of different influences come into the party. Then Donald Trump showed up on the scene By the way, when we first came up with the name of the circus, everybody's like, oh, that's over the top. That's too much. Now. I thought that there was just a drift in the party, not a clear sort of moral axis or ideological axis, really, that was becoming less clear to me, that it wasn't cohesive in the way that I found, you know, other Republicans to be. And then with this president being elected, the kind of things that I cared about and the reason I became a Republican were anathema to this guy. I mean, free trade. I mean, I'm kind of a radical free trader. Deficits. You know, he's like, what does he say about debt? You know, give me more. And so there's just some sort of fundamentals that to me make – that are problematic for the party, not just now but long term.
Where do you – nobody knows, but what seems to you like the most likely near-term future for the Republican Party? Next 4 to 8 years or 10 years? Or is it totally unknowable? Is there no most
I think
likely?
It's unknowable. I have thought for a long time, even previous to this election, that there was the possibility that somebody's going to make an independent run. And Trump kind of did that, but did it as a Republican, you know, but a lot of the features of his candidacies.
Right?
Yes, exactly right. So I think that now, I think Trump will almost certainly win the nomination. I think he's almost certainly going to run. It's hard to imagine psychologically there'd be any circumstance that he'd walk away because he'd be thought of as a loser, which is the worst possible thing for him. So you have him as the standard bearer for the, quote, Republican Party. And then if you elect somebody like, let's just say, Elizabeth Warren wins, or somebody pretty progressive. That leaves a pretty big hole in the middle for somebody. Now, I don't know that Howard Schultz is the guy, John Kasich, or somebody else out there who would like go back to fundamental Republican principles that a lot of us hold dear and kind of rebrand and restart the Republican Party under a different banner. That's kind of one option I see.
Like go Bull Moose, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
With the Democrats, if you were going to just jump into that race, which horse would you want to ride?
Well, I mean, there's horses.
I don't mean as a personal preference because you like politician A more than politician B. I just meant as a professional.
As a professional. How would I handicap it, you mean?
And who would you want to – which candidate would you want to work if you were jumping in there because you find their position interesting or their potential currently underrated or –
Well, I mean, the couple of people that I really like, I'll get that out of the way first. I mean, I like John Hickenlooper, and I'm from Colorado, so he's my kind of guy. He's very centrist.
That's what I say. No value judgments attached to this answer.
Yeah, and Mitch Landrieu, too, but I don't think he's going to run. Just in terms of what I've seen so far in candidate skills and rollout and what have you, I think Kamala Harris is in a very strong position, particularly because of what's happening with the California primary being moved up. So that's going to be a huge delegate haul early in the process now. And I just think she checks a lot of boxes. I think right now to be a woman of color in a Democratic primary is a huge advantage. I think because of her prosecutor background, it's oddly a potential problem for her in the primary, but it's good for her in the general. It says to me a lot about the Democratic Party that would be a problem, that she was a prosecutor. But I just think, you know, you just take out the list of sort of top 10 things, geography, gender, color, money, California, that's a lot of boxes.
How are her candidate skills?
They're pretty good from what I've seen. I don't know her very well, but she's got a great laugh that I've seen. That's kind of an authentic kind of side of her that I saw a little bit of that people say they really like. She also, you know, she says she has really sharp elbows, which I think you got to have. You know, of course you do. She's running for president, second year. I guess maybe the one check against her would be that when you're replacing a president, it's almost always a total contrast, right? You know, you had Carter to Nixon. That's those, you know, Obama to Bush, Trump to Obama. So you could argue in that case that experience will be an important factor. And she doesn't have a lot of experience. I mean, she was a prosecutor, but not a lot in the Senate, just 2 years. But maybe that's I think people would say, well, Obama did it, so if she could do it, why not?
What would I have this insane suspicion that there's like a 1 in 3 chance that somebody we are not even thinking about jumps into the race at some point because you've got 15 candidates, nobody's over 25%, and all of a sudden Democrats are looking around saying, wait a minute, these guys don't look like a super strong field. They actually look like the JV team. We need, you know, and there's like a draft Michelle moment or, you know, is Oprah going to
I heard some of that Sunday night from the Grammys, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, something like
Oprah.
That or the Oprah, you know, we need her speech like we had at the Academy Awards last year. Do you think, I guess, you know, A, do you think there will be any appetite for that among Democrats? And B, logistically, would that even be possible for somebody that we're not thinking of to get in like in the summer?
I think what you're putting your finger on, which is likely to happen, there's going to be a ton of dissonance in the Democrats. They, at one, on one hand, they're like, they see Trump as so vulnerable. And on the other hand, they just screw it up all over the place. You know, and Trump's State of the Union speech was like the first time I was watching it say, you know, the Democrats could really screw this up. They really could. And we kind of did a socialism deal. Yeah. You know, which any other era would have been like a bridge too far. But right now, Democrats are actually talking about some pretty lefty ideas that, and you can just see what Trump's going to do with that. Going to crank that up to 11 and just let it roar. You know, God, there was a poll the other day that showed that among millennials, more choose socialism than capitalism. So
they don't know anything.
This is a reality problem. to tap into, I guess.
Not Jim, who's a true scholar, but I'm consistently amazed at like the people under the age of 25 or 26 who I've worked with, who for whom the Cold War might as well be World War One.
Yeah,
it's so distant to them. Yeah. They, you know, like, oh, what was that thing?
Yeah. So they don't have the same context for these ideas or these arguments that we do.
Do you think that Democrats are repeating the problems that Republicans suffered the last time around with so many candidates? Alluding to your,
yeah, kind of getting back to your point, I think what happens then is you have the Democrats who are so hungry to take the presidency and then see the split up field with nobody sort of dominating it, and they get nervous. So, which kind of plays into the playbook that you're talking about. And they, you know, we'll go knock on Michelle Obama's door.
Yeah. I guess when I take the other side of that argument, I think about Trump, right? And so in 2016, Republicans were desperate to take back the White House. They thought Barack Obama was the most evil socialist, blah, 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 ever. And there was a real focus on electability within the party and the party mm-hmm. elders. And they thought, mm-hmm. well, yeah, we have to have our autopsy. We can't go too far in immigration. We got to.
Right.
And they wind up electing the most polarizing guy possible. And it worked out.
Yeah.
And this is why I wonder if you're Democrat, can you talk yourself into saying that actually it's all base turnout and we just need to lean into this? I don't know. I don't know if I agree with it, but I do wonder if Democrats will talk themselves around into that and say, well, why not just run with a real progressive, and that will help with turnout. And
I think you're going to see a lot of that. I think you'll see a lot of that argument. And then I think you also have a very counter-conventional notion, which is the rationale for Hickenlooper, which is, okay, if there's like 9 radical progressives running in Iowa and me.
Right. Why not be there?
I got a shot.
Why not be here? Right. Or
I can win with 15%.
Yeah.
You think it'll be interesting, too, to see if there isn't, you know, some kind of destructive force like Trump was the last time around, the degree to which, we talked about this on a podcast earlier, Kirsten Gillibrand is the most willing to knife people in the chest. And Kamala Harris, you know, she throws elbows, and Amy Klobuchar is kind of being Minnesota nice and making fun of Hillary with her trolling campaign. But when do you think that the heat is really going to get turned up as more and more people are in?
I do, yeah. I think that drift, progressive drift in the Democratic primaries is going to be hard for people to resist. It really is. And that's where I say that could get so out of hand that it could see a scenario where Trump gets in a, let's say, a stronger position. For sure.
Right, because some candidates that people might love, like, dearly, could get so broken by other candidates who win under no circumstances. You know, you see this a little bit with the Bernie bros and Hillary.
Yeah, exactly.
But that rift, I think, you know, widen as there are more candidates, fracture it more.
Well, the way this thing turns out, it might make the circus look like a zoo.
So we should end on something nice and hopeful. You seem to have been incredibly early on Obama as a political commodity. When you look around American politics today, is there anybody else who you think to yourself, it would be better for all of this if this person were to make a run and become like a more serious national politician? Not like, hey, they'd be the next president or something like that.
I think Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
I think he's a really interesting guy. I think he has a really unique and refreshing voice. I think he's probably going to run. You look at his options, like he's hot now and that dissipates, you know. And so what, he's going to wait 4 years and do it? You got to go when you got the juice, and he's got the juice. And I think it's going to be really interesting because he's an interesting, thoughtful voice, and he's a voice that to me has the most important component if you're running for president today, and that's an air of authenticity. That's something that people loved about Trump, his base supporters loved. Remember when he did his announcement speech? It wasn't even written. He just made it up on the stage.
Yeah.
And the professionals among us were like, oh, my God. You know, we spend months and weeks, you know, getting it right and a teleprompter. And he just like threw it all out the window and just said, I'm just going to say whatever's on my mind. And he did. And it was, you know, that's when he said that, you know, the Mexicans are coming over, the rapists. And Trump supporters loved it. That's exactly what they wanted to see. They wanted to see somebody doing something so completely different that they didn't even write up their speech.
All right. Well, listen, Mark McKinnon, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I love talking to campaign nerds. This is fun.
Absolutely fantastic. We'll be back again tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.
Kick it hard. Carry on regardless.